On this episode of Skeptico.
One of the many aspects of it that is completely ridiculous is someone who claims to be a reasonable man and tries to be in accord with science, the Dalai Lama, bases his whole position is based on something absolutely ridiculous. If he really believed in what he said, if he really put his money where his mouth is, he would resign as Dalai Lama, because the Dalai Lama is based on reincarnation, which is just nonsense.
Well, I don't know if it's just nonsense. I mean,
it is just nonsense.
But I just talked to Jim Tucker, you know, respected psychologist in the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at University of Virginia. They've done just extensive work, published in the best journals in their field, and they offer the only explanation for what they found in terms of reincarnation. I think you would really have to tell me specifically what is wrong with, back to science, what's wrong with the scientific method that they've employed?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we continue on the theme of atheism and its sometimes strange entanglement with science. At least it seems strange to me. Our guest, of course, is Arizona State Professor of Theoretical Physics, Dr. Lawrence Krauss, who is a very popular and well-known figure in the atheist and skeptical communities and was recently featured along with Richard Dawkins in the movie The Unbelievers. During this interview, we talk about, of course, reincarnation science, at least I do. We talk about extraordinary claims and extraordinary proof. That's a topic you know I've talked about many times, and Dr. Krauss and I give it a go on that one as well. And finally, since Dr. Krauss is a well-known advocate of the meaningless universe concept, we talk about morality and how morality can exist in a meaningless universe. It was a great pleasure to have Dr. Krauss on the show. I certainly appreciate him joining me and his willingness to dig into some of these tough issues. I hope you enjoy the interview. Today, we welcome renowned theoretical physicist Dr. Lawrence Krauss to Skeptico. In addition to his day job as a professor in the Department of Physics at Arizona State University, Dr. Krauss is also a successful author. His book, A Universe from Nothing, was a New York Times bestseller. And most recently, he was featured in, along with Dr. Richard Dawkins, a very well-done documentary on atheism titled The Unbelievers. Dr. Krauss, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, virtually at least.
Right. So the movie, The Unbelievers, it's very well done, packed with clips from not only well-known figures in the atheist community, some impressive celebrity cameos are in there as well. I thought you came across very well in the film. You look very relaxed, like you're having fun. Was it that easy for you to be in front of the cameras for that extended period of time?
Well, I always try to have fun, so I guess that's part of it. The crew was a wonderful group of young men, and of course you get used to it. It's intrusive, but it was an enjoyable experience. Yeah, it was generally enjoyable. They were as non-intrusive as they could be, and I think they're wonderful young filmmakers. And the goal was worth the effort, and it was kind of fun to see what they would do with it. So yeah, I guess I do what I do, for the most part, because I enjoy it.
Well, you know, one of the things that you do when you do, I think, and I'm sure this is in real life as well, but it certainly comes through in the film, is, you know, you engage with folks that disagree with you, and you do that in a you know, very vigorous way, but also a fun, respectful way. One of the scenes I really like from the film is this debate you do early on with this group of Muslim students in Australia. Maybe you want to set up that scene a little bit and tell us how much that's like other debates and kind of encounters you do on a regular basis, but pretty often.
Nothing. I do so many different things. It's hard to say anything's regular, but that was an interesting event because it was a Muslim debating society that asked me to do this, and I didn't really know what I was in for. They seemed like they were legitimately interested. They didn't have an agenda, and I've done some debates where people have had an agenda, And as I say in the movie, what was kind of strange is it was only advertised, as far as I can see, among the Muslim community. It wasn't, even though it was supposed to be a public event, I didn't see any advertisement of it elsewhere. So I had no sense of what the audience would be like or what kind of hostilities. But it was at the same time, while unfortunately it was a young man and I think somewhat inexperienced, it was a respectful event. And I totally indicate where I thought his ideas were ridiculous. And as I've said before, finding someone's ideas ridiculous is not the same as demeaning them. But afterwards, it was a largely Muslim group, and what's kind of fun is that afterwards I signed books for people who were wearing, you know, shawls and kerchiefs over their heads and things. But also we stayed till, I think the thing I liked best, and I don't know if you captured it, but it was sort of subtle in the movie, was they showed it going on till 11 o'clock at night, which it did do, because I answered questions as long as possible. And then I had fun chatting with the people I'd been debating with for another half hour in the back. And I think you can see that at the end of the movie. And so, or at the end of the scene. And that was very pleasant, because it meant, you know, while we disagreed and they wanted to raise the issues, and they had an honest interest in really having an honest dialogue and not in promoting some ideology.
Right, right. I think that did come through. You know, the other thing I thought you did a nice job of in the film, and obviously you're a scientist with a very strong scientific research background, and you really talk about science as a method, not a position, you know, and you even say it's about being proven wrong. And, you know, hey, when have you been proven wrong? It's great to be proven wrong. I do it all the time. I really like that. The reality, I think, that comes through in the film, though, is it's tough. And I understand that it's tough because science does get pulled into policy debates, culture war debates, and it's really hard not to say science says this or science says that. And in some cases, I understand, you know, when you're talking about whether Common Descent or Noah's Ark is a better explanation for why we're here, shorthand is to say science says so. But isn't there kind of a problem there? I mean,
of course there is. You should never appeal to authority if you can't. And there are many. It's easy to fall into traps. For example, to use the word "believe," I believe this to be the case. And so belief is not something we should mention as a scientist. It's something likely or more unlikely, but belief doesn't enter into it. We tend to say it. I try and catch myself now. You know, they say, "Do you believe in evolution?" Well, belief, it doesn't matter. Evolution happened whether you believe it or not. And I think on the whole, what we can argue is that, sure, you shouldn't take things on faith. On the other hand, you can't be an expert at everything. And you can ask yourself skeptically, given the different groups who are trying to argue, and what is their agenda? What do they have to gain? And when it comes to scientific issues, am I more likely to trust scientists whose real job is not to promote an ideology, but to find out how things work? Or should I believe people who clearly have an agenda or an ideology that they're pushing? And in fact, the argument when you say, talk about Noah's Ark versus, you know, Common Descent, is to say, well, you know, just there's no evidence for one, there's tons of evidence for the other. And I think it's whenever possible, it's to argue why the scientific community heads in a certain direction, not that they have. But of course, every now and then, one has to say, if you're gonna, without knowing, guess which group might be more trustworthy on climate change, is it climate scientists who are really there? They earn the same amount whether the climate is changing or not. They're trying to figure out what works. Or people, say, in the oil industry. I mean, who is more likely to want to convince you of an idea that benefits them?
Yeah, but it does get tricky, as it does with, you know, climate scientists, because there's the oil company on one side and there's people selling carbon credits on the other. You know, it just, as soon as we get into the public policy issue, to a certain extent, all bets are off. But even if we stick with evolution, you know,
I disagree. I think it's specifically when it comes to public policy that this matters, that we have to explain to people that they should be skeptical of all groups, but they should be skeptical and they should look for evidence. And in fact, they should ask, is this policy based on empirical data? And if so, is that empirical data reliable? Those are the kind of questions that we should all be asking when it comes to public policy, whether we're voting for someone or whether a member of the Congress. The reason I tend to get involved in public policy issues as well as science is because I want public policy to be based. And I don't want scientists to decide what the policies are. Because when it comes to climate change, for example, you may say, look, I understand the cause of climate change, but for this reason or this economic reason or whatever, we can't act now. Well, I disagree with that, but at least it's a rational, it's a policy that you can defend on some basis instead of pretending that climate change doesn't happen or is a hoax. And so I really want public policy to be based on science whenever it can be, so that the policymakers can be informed and make decisions, and the voters can be informed enough to vote to know who is full of garbage.
Well, that's wonderful, and there's no disagreement with that. I think the mechanics of it and the details of it are a lot harder. You know, someone I look to is Judith Curry at Georgia Tech University, as qualified and as well-published a climate change expert, head of the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Science or something like that, well-respected, but, you know, kind of tears apart a lot of the pillars of some of the climate change stuff. She's somebody who says, hey, climate change is happening, but we have to be very careful in the policies that we adopt. And in there, you can really come to just about any conclusion you want to along a wide spectrum of policy choices. But I don't want to get off on climate change because there's so many more interesting things to talk to you about. But I would take that same point and bring it back even to evolution and neo-Darwinism. You know, one of the folks who's been on this show several times and is a friend of this show is Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Cambridge biologist, published in Nature, somebody who has all the qualifications, who, if you sat him down across the table from Richard Dawkins, would have some very sharp pointed disagreements about neo-Darwinism. You know, not the same as somebody from a Baptist. I'm sorry.
I hate that word neo-Darwinism. I don't know what it means.
Okay, well,
it seems to me people use it as a pejorative label to make it seem like it's neocons or whatever. It's like saying neo-gravity. I mean, of course, our views about gravity have evolved, but the basic idea of natural selection, mutation, and driven by natural selection is not an idea that's either controversial or changed because it's been subject to testing for 150 years. Anyway, I'm jumping on you for that because, you know, I see it, people called neo-Darwinist and also new atheists, as if I don't quite understand what new atheists are. It's a wonderful label to make people seem like they have an agenda or are suspect, but I don't understand what new atheism is. So anyway.
Well, I mean, we could talk about new atheism too. I don't see it necessarily as a pejorative term. I see it as identifying with a certain movement of folks that had a certain, you know, vigor and energized force to bring to a movement that was kind of, I don't want to say dead, but was really not as active and as current and meaningful. So I don't think new atheism is necessarily a bad term. As far as neo-Darwinism, my point is just that, you know, here is Rupert Sheldrake, who gets called pseudoscientist and all the rest of this because of this same thing. It's science becomes a position statement. And when people object to someone's position, especially there's these certain categories that seem to be protected in some way, for example, the theory of evolution, that we can't move towards having that meaningful dialogue in the back of the room that you talked about with that group of Muslims. And I've seen this over and over again in years of doing this show. So I think,
I think one has to be, yes, that's true. But as I say, being respectful of individuals and being respectful of ideas are two different things. And I think people invent controversies too often where there are no controversies, from climate change to evolution. I've seen it happen. I've watched it happen. And for better or worse, people who are on the, there are a number of people in science who are on the margin. And science, of course, it's hard to have a new idea and it's hard to break through because science is done by scientists and they're human. But at the same time, there's often a reason why people are on the margin. And one should be, I mean,
No. Now, there we go again. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. There isn't any standard other than the method of science and what science has in place. I mean, peer review is supposed to take care of that. It's supposed to bring the people on the fringe either in and they get published or they don't. We don't need this kind of meta rule, meta analysis. You know, it's like when I talk to folks and they want to say, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. How is that scientific? It's not. What we have works. We just have to apply it. We don't need someone on the outside at the end of the game, at the end of the football game, saying, oh, no, you didn't win by enough. You have to kick another field goal. That's not quite an extraordinary victory.
You're going to make an extraordinary claim in science. That means you're in some sense contradicting. I mean, generally, an extraordinary claim is contradicting accepted wisdom, which is based on wisdom, is based on the evidence. So you're saying the conventional ideas and theories are wrong. And if you're going to make that claim, then you've got to have a darn good reason to make it. And most of the time people make that claim, and it happens, I get that letters every day from people who say, oh, all of physics is wrong, and I'll tell you why. Well, you know, I know that essentially.
But are they publishing in top-notch journals of physics? I think if they are, you do have to pay attention to it, because that's the way the game is played. You can't.
Yeah, but so you also have to be skeptical of stuff in top-notch journals. I think.
Sure.
It's but as you said, it's a process. But I do believe that extraordinary claims do require extraordinary evidence. That a little science is often done by baby steps. But if you're claiming a scientific revolution, which most, when someone is claiming to make a revolutionary result, you can be pretty well certain most of the time that they're not. And every now and then, one times out of 1,000 or 100,000, it's right. But it's a pretty safe assumption that you should be darn skeptical.
I don't know. Let's move on in your limited amount of time, because I want to talk about religion, too. It's another area that you cover extensively in the movie, because that's what the movie is kind of about, this scientific opposition to some of the craziness that we see, not in religious people, but in the practice and how it's carried out. And I get that on one hand. On the other hand, there's some things that I guess are a little troubling to me when at one point in the movie, Richard Dawkins says, I don't despise religious people. I despise what they stand for. I mean, I guess I have to ask you, first of all, I mean, I think I understand what he's saying, but can we really endorse that kind of statement?
Well, look, I mean, he was speaking to a crowd and in a context. And I think what he meant is we can despise. I think it's true that if you look at the scriptures of most major religions, those are despicable. Now, of course, it's generalizing. It's a huge stereotype to claim that all religious people stand for those scriptures. But nevertheless, it's the basis of what the religion is what they claim is their religion. The scriptures are pretty despicable. You wouldn't want to live a life based on the dictates of the Old Testament. It's worse than the ISIS.
Okay, but there's a lot of atheists, Sam Harris is one, who are practicing Buddhists. There's a large community. So, I mean, when we lump all this together and say, I don't despise religious people, I despise what they stand for. I mean, what's really troubling to me is, you know, it's just the kind of stuff you guys rail against, and that logic could be turned around and used to hate any group. You know, oh, you stand for this, and that's what I hate. I don't hate you, but you stand for this, and I hate that.
I was making an inflammatory statement, and I think, look, I agree that on the whole, anything, the minute you get people's hackles up, you're subject to the problems of trying to have communication. But I think it's worth pointing out to me, in some generic sense, that anything that denies, that is inconsistent with the evidence of reality, that is used as a tenet for a living, is in some sense, well, I would say it's ridiculous. Richard would say it's despicable. But I said that to Sam Harris when I talked to him about the fact that, well, it's nice, fine and nice to say Buddhism is a kinder, gentler kind of, he wouldn't call it a religion, of course, because it's a kinder, gentler way of thinking, but it's based, one of the many aspects of it that is completely ridiculous is someone who claims to be a reasonable man and tries to be in accord with science, the Dalai Lama, his whole position is based on something absolutely ridiculous. If he really believed in what he said, if he really put his money where his mouth is, he would resign as Dalai Lama, because the Dalai Lama is based on reincarnation, which is just nonsense.
Well, I don't know if it's just nonsense.
It's nonsense.
We have a group of people, and I didn't have a chance to talk to Ian Stevenson from the University of Virginia because he's passed away, but I just talked to Jim Tucker, you know, respected psychologist in the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at University of Virginia. They've done just extensive work, published in the best journals in their field. And I don't know how anyone could criticize what they've done, and they offer the only explanation for what they found in terms of reincarnation. So,
There are more people alive today than there have been in the sum of human history up to about 100 years ago. So I don't exactly know where the souls. I mean, you just got to ask.
I don't know, but that's a different question, isn't it? I mean,
what you can do is ask yourself the following. I guide myself by the mantra, if you wish, speaking of Buddhism, of the editor of the New York Times, who said, I'd like to keep an open mind, but not so open that my brains fall out.
Well, my wife heard that when she was in Bible school.
Everything I know about science to argue that reincarnation is likely. All we can say, look, in science we can't say something's impossible per se. Certain things we can, perhaps, if they're well-tested. But what we can say is it's extremely unlikely. It's likely versus unlikely. It's extremely unlikely there's a God. Just like it's extremely unlikely there's a teapot orbiting Jupiter, it's extremely unlikely from the same point of view of every bit of science that I know of, including the evidence of logic as well as empiricism, that reincarnation occurs. Certainly from a physics perspective, there's no mechanism. From a perspective of just counting numbers, much less a perspective of the fact that there's no such evidence, any evidentiary existence for the existence of something you might call a soul. None of that that's all grand speculation which doesn't have any basis in evidence. And so therefore, as a scientist, I'm incredibly skeptical about it.
Okay.
And so that's what I mean by nonsense. There's no, it's just as likely that reincarnation exists to me as there is the likelihood that there's a teapot orbiting Jupiter. Now, I can't prove there isn't. Just like I can't in some sense.
I mean, I've heard all that stuff before, and I don't want to go there too far because I don't think, you know, I'd love to sit down and debate the evidence with you or have Dr. Jim Tucker from University of Virginia or other people that have studied it, published on it. You know, I don't think you're familiar with that research, so I don't think it's really
at some point, as Richard Feynman said, there's lots of things I could study. I choose to study those things that are likely to be realistic or reasonable or make progress. And there's lots of, I don't study UFOs either.
But the other thing, see, there is, I mean, and again, then we're going to move on. I think you would really have to tell me specifically what is wrong with, back to science, what's wrong with the scientific method that they've employed? Because I don't know how else you get to that question. If you take kind of a natural science perspective and say, hey, there's a lot of people, billions of people really, who report this, right? Or have reported this over history, reincarnation. Then you say, okay, I want to investigate it. How would you investigate it? And then you go look at how Ian Stevenson, Jim Tucker, and these other people have investigated it. And then you'd say, okay, but oh, here's the fatal flaw in the way they've approached answering that question. I talked to a professor of philosophy, Dr. Robert Almeter, the other day. Highly, highly regarded. I forget what fancy title he has and what awards he's won. But this is his point. He says, I was not inclined to believe this at all, but the methodology, I found no fault in it. The work, I found no fault in it. So I am forced, compelled to only say that these are the only guys who have looked at the data, and their hypothesis for what the explanation is the only one out there. If somebody comes up with a better one, I'm willing to hear it. But
well, you know, those people can spend their time doing that. I told you before, I can investigate. I used to debate in the old days in UFO people. They'd say, do you know about this episode in 1946? And if you haven't investigated that completely, how can you tell me that UFOs are not likely visiting? What I can say is it's highly unlikely. I don't have the time or inclination I have to be convinced by some piece of evidence that suggested it was worth my time to understand why that professor erred. And then, after all, as I told you, much of the stuff that's published, even as prestigious journals, is garbage. And I'm very skeptical of many of the things that are done in psychology, I have to admit. But I don't have the time or inclination to investigate something that is highly likely to be wrong.
You don't have the time. Let's stick to that, because right now I know you're pressed for time, and I do appreciate the time you spent with me. I hope people do check out The Unbelievers. It's really, I think, no matter which side of this fence you sit on, unless you're kind of a very religious person, then the movie might not be for you. But it's easy to access. You can get it on, I think I watch it on Netflix for free, but you can also watch it through Amazon, any number of places, DVD, all that good stuff. But one last question. A couple weeks ago, I had a chance to talk to Michael Shermer about his new book, The Moral Arc, and which I thought is a very fine book, and it makes the case that these moral trends that we're all, I guess we could say, proud of and identify with as a culture, those trends in the last couple of years cannot be traced to religion, can't be traced to some scripture that was found under a rock or anything like that, but can only be traced from us, from our logic, our reason, our society. Now, that's all well and good, and we can all feel good about that, and I think atheists can feel good about that. But we come across, you know, I saw in the film that you're at the Global Atheist Convention, and you say, which you've said a million times before, you know, there's no meaning in the universe, right? There's no meaning.
No evidence of meaning, yeah.
Okay, well, but shorthand, there's no meaning. The point is, we can't really connect those. I think atheists have a real hard time because, come on, let's be honest. Logically, if there's no meaning in the universe, then there's no meaning in life. There's no moral imperative. There's no way to connect that with Shermer's moral arc.
If you listen to the full part of that movie, my point was that you make your own meaning. You make your own meaning in life and try and make your own contribution. It makes my life much more precious to know that the universe doesn't give a damn about what I'm doing. And I can determine what I'm doing and decide whether it's worthwhile or not. It gives me much more energy, motivation.
I got all that, but my own meaning inside of a universe, a world that has no meaning, is an illusion. I mean, this is one of the tenets of atheism. Daniel Dennett, consciousness is an illusion. I mean, this is...
what it is. It is something that we determine as humans has meaning to us, that certain things are important or certain things are not important. They're not globally important. Whether humanity survives or not doesn't matter at all to the universe. We're irrelevant to the universe. But we decide it's important because we are fortunate enough to have brains and an ability to have foresight and an ability to plan our actions. And we therefore have the great luxury of trying to effectively work to make our own lives and the lives around us better. But that's a person, that's a human decision, and in a global sense, in a cosmic sense, it's completely irrelevant. But it doesn't make it any less important because I'm living on Earth. I'm not living somewhere else. I'm a human surrounded by other humans, and therefore the importance that I attribute to my activities as a human is based on my experience as a human. And I recognize that, and nothing more and nothing less, but it enlivens me and it inspires me to do my best. I think it's probably a good time to go.
Okay, I don't see how that's anything less than an illusion, but another discussion for another time. It's been great talking to you again, folks. The movie that you want to check out is The Unbelievers, starring our guest today, Dr. Lawrence Krauss. It's been great having you on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks again to Dr. Krauss for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, one pushback I anticipate from this interview is folks saying, you know, Dr. Krauss doesn't really represent mainstream science. He's kind of on the edge, kind of has an extreme position. But I have to disagree. You know, certainly there aren't many professors at a major state university that would openly call for the Dalai Lama to step down. That is extreme. But I tell you what, I think science as we know it, the institution of science, loves when Dr. Krauss steps out there and says these kind of things. He's the barking dog on the chain that keeps everyone in line. It's just like when Richard Dawkins says, I don't despise religious people. I despise what they stand for. So don't expect any outcry from science groups admonishing Dr. Krauss for remarks that many will find offensive, insensitive, and from a scientific standpoint, unsubstantiated, but we won't even go there. And don't expect any outcry because you haven't heard it about Richard Dawkins' comments, even though it opens the door to hate any group that you don't like. Oh, I take it back. We don't hate them. We hate what they stand for. No, science falls in line with these ideas because they've been conditioned to think it supports this phony battle between science and religion that occupies so much of our time. So I'm, of course, very glad that Dr. Krauss came on Skeptico and shared these ideas, because I think they are representative of the institution of science, science as we know it, of its current position regarding these issues. So with that, let me offer up a couple of questions from this interview. Question number one, is reincarnation nonsense? And I'd ask that question from a scientific standpoint. How would we approach the question of reincarnation? Since it's such a widely held belief, many people having not only a belief in it by birth, but an actual experience of it, of memories, of recollections of previous lives. How would we explore such a question scientifically? Question number two, how can your life have any meaning if you live in a meaningless universe? I've asked this question to so many atheists and skeptics, and I never seem to get an answer. And I don't think I got an answer from Dr. Krauss either. I mean, this is simple logic, folks. If the entire universe is meaningless, then how is it possible that your life has any meaning, any real meaning? Of course, you can pretend like your life has meaning, but it's inside of a universe that has no meaning. How is that possible? And finally, I'd offer up one answer to Dr. Krauss's question of how can reincarnation exist if there's more people on the planet now than ever before? The answer is, I don't know, because we haven't investigated how reincarnation might work and what is the nature of consciousness that might exist outside the body. You know, when I was listening to Dr. Krauss and his ramblings on extraordinary claims and extraordinary proof, I couldn't help but remember a recent interview I did with radio host Tim Banal, and I thought he had an excellent reworking of that phrase. And his is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary investigations. I think Tim's got it right on the money. So finally, if you'd like to jump in and answer any of those questions, or if you have any other comments about this show, the place to connect with us is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can leave a comment right there on the website, or jump over to the forum section and join us in conversation over there. It's very easy to do. Just takes a minute to register. We never bug you with emails or mailing lists or anything like that. It's just a place for people to connect and talk. Finally, you can connect with me via Facebook or, of course, send me an email. By the way, thanks to everyone for all the support on the show. I've gotten a lot of good feedback on some of the interviews I've been doing in support of my book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. It's been so fun to do. I was recently on Mysterious Universe. That was a lot of fun. I was also on the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell. That was great as well. I'm posting some of those links to those interviews on the book website, whyscienceiswrong.com. Be sure to check that out if you're at all interested. Otherwise, keep listening. I appreciate it. I love hearing how people have found the show. I love hearing how people recommend the show to their friends and other people. It's so great to spread this community and get more people thinking and talking about these topics. It's a real charge for me when we do that. So I hope we can just continue doing it as much as we can. I do have a bunch of really good shows coming up. I feel a little bit of an obligation to get these out. I have been holding on to some of them for a while, but it's just hard to get everything moving and get them all out. But I'm going to keep trying to do that. There's some really good ones coming up, though. Please stay tuned for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.